is Our American Stories. And I want to bring you a story that a friend of the show and a friend of Alex's, Evan Baer, posted. And we look for these kind of things everywhere. They don't have to be in major newspapers or on CNN. People are posting and publishing in any number of ways. We want to turn that into storytelling here on this show. So always be looking to send us material. We'll take it. Go to our website. You can figure out how right there, ouramericannetwork.org. It is such a moving story that it's gone viral twice, when it was originally published in 2015, and then again when it was recently republished. This is the power of stories, folks. They're timeless. And that's why we don't do the news here. You got plenty of places to get the news. Good luck. We don't want to do the news. There are lots of places you can go, but here it's stories. We reached out to the author of this piece by Paul Doherty to ask him to record it for us. Here's Paul sharing his very personal story to my Down syndrome daughter on her wedding day.
Dear Jillian, it is the afternoon of your wedding, June 27th, 2015. In 2 hours, you will take the walk of a lifetime, a stroll made more memorable by what you've achieved to get to this day. I don't know what the odds are of a woman with Down syndrome marrying the love of her life. I only know you've beaten them. You are upstairs now, making final preparations with your mom and bridesmaids. Your hair is coiled perfectly above your slender neck. Your bejeweled dress, my bling, you called it, attracts every glimmer of late afternoon sunshine pouring through the window. Your makeup, that red lipstick, somehow improves upon a beauty that has grown since the day you were born. Your smile is blooming and everlasting. I'm outside, beneath that window, staring up. We live for moments such as these, Jillian, when hopes and dreams intersect at a sweet spot in time, when everything we've always imagined arrives and assumes a perfect clarity. Bliss is possible. I know that now, standing beneath that window. I have everything and nothing to tell you. When you were born and for years afterward, I didn't worry for what you'd achieve academically. Your mom and I would make that happen. We'd wield the law like a cudgel if we had to. We could make teachers teach you, and we knew you'd earn the respect of your peers. What we couldn't do was make other kids like you, accept you, befriend you, stand with you in the vital social arena. We thought, what's a kid's life like if it isn't filled with sleepovers and birthday parties and dates to the prom? I worried about you then. I cried deep inside on the night when you were 12 and you came downstairs to declare, I don't have any friends. We all wish the same things for our children. Health, happiness, and a keen ability to engage and enjoy the world are not only the province of typical kids, their pursuit is every child's birthright. I worried about your pursuit, Jillian. I shouldn't have. You're a natural when it comes to socializing. They called you the mayor in elementary school for your ability to engage everyone. You danced on the junior varsity dance team in high school. You spent 4 years attending college classes and made lifelong impressions on everyone you met. Do you remember all the stuff they said you'd never do, Jills? You wouldn't ride a two-wheeler. You wouldn't play sports. You wouldn't go to college. You certainly wouldn't get married. Now, look at you. You're the nicest person I know. Someone who is able to live a life of empathy and sympathy, and without agendas or guile, is someone we all want to know. It worked out for you because of the person you are. I would tell you to give your fiancé, Ryan, your whole heart, but that would be stating the obvious. I would tell you to be kind to him and gentle with him, but you do that already, with everyone you know. I would wish for you a lifetime of friendship and mutual respect, but you two have been together a decade already, so the respect and friendship already are apparent. A decade ago, when a young man walked to our door wearing a suit and bearing a corsage made of cymbidium orchids said, I'm here to take your daughter to the homecoming, sir, every fear I have ever had about your life being incomplete vanished. Now you and Ryan are taking a different walk together. It's a new challenge, but it's no more daunting for you than for anyone else. Given who you are, it might be less so. Happiness comes easily to you, as does your ability to make happiness for others. I see you now. The prep work has been done. The door swings open. My little girl, all in white, crossing the threshold of yet another conquered dream. I stand breathless and transfixed, utterly in the moment. You look beautiful, is the best I can do. Jillian thanks me. I'll always be your little girl, is what she says then. Yes, you will, I manage. Time to go, I say. We have a walk to make.
And what a beautiful story. And Paul, thanks for sharing it with us. And the odds of a person with Down syndrome getting married is unknown. The odds of people diagnosed with Down syndrome who are allowed to simply live is just as low. 90% won't. So that she made it to birth and then made it to marriage, it's an unbelievable story. And so, Evan, thanks for sharing this. And that's why when we run across stories like this, we just have to do them. You turn on the dial so many places in this country and you don't get stories like this, and yet they're happening every day under our breath. And these are beautiful stories. And I just, you know, he's saying there, my little girl, all in white, I stood breathless and transfixed, utterly in the moment. And then you could tell the dad had nothing to say, but you look beautiful. And my goodness, the daughter teaching the father lessons. The Down syndrome daughter teaching all of us about life, about love, and about the love of God. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we're back with our weekly segment with Nate Scott from For the Win, USA Today's leading sports site at ftw.usatoday.com. And you can't talk right now without talking about what happened this year in the NBA. And Nate, what a series, what a time for the NBA. Talk about what we saw. What's your takeaway?
Man, I'll tell you, Golden State Warriors just finished the greatest regular season in NBA history. They won 73 games. I thought they would cruise to a title, and if anyone was going to beat them, I'd figure it'd be someone in the West. And then the Cleveland Cavaliers and LeBron James found another level, and it took them seven games, but they upset the Warriors, and they kind of rewrote the whole narrative of this season with one game. And it was just so fun to watch.
It really was. And there were a lot of lead changes in the last game. But you're also seeing two very different styles of basketball in the end. I mean, the Cavs held the Warriors in check. And that amazing offense, well, it didn't even hit 100 points. It didn't hit 90, Nate. What was going on there?
LeBron found a way to motivate that team. And, you know, when the Warriors, they lost Draymond Green one game to a suspension. They lost Andrew Bogut, who was arguably their best rim protector. And when that happened, the Warriors weren't able to defend and cause turnovers like they liked. Cleveland was able to slow the whole game down. And by slowing the game down, they were able to focus on Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, make life really, really difficult for them. And made it really difficult for the Warriors to do what they want. But the Warriors thrive in chaos. And when the Cavaliers were able to slow the game down and let LeBron James do what he does, they were able to win the series that way.
Yeah, I think so. And now tell me, as a takeaway, The way the Warriors played, the number of three-point shots taken, do you think people are going to start to draft differently? Are they going to look for more Steph Currys? Are they going to look for more Thompsons? And that is, are they going to be looking for guys who can really shoot and pass?
You're already seeing it. It's already happening. A guy named Jaylen Brown might go as high as number three in the draft this year. In years past, he's a 6'7" kid who's kind of an inside player, kind of an outside player. You know, 5-10 years ago, he was called a tweener. Basically, teams didn't want him because he wasn't tall enough to play power forward, but he wasn't quite a guard. Now those guys are the most valuable players in the league because they can shoot threes. They're strong enough to defend multiple positions. You can play them in multiple positions. And it's just, you know, gone are the days of little point guards and seven-footers. Now those mid-range guys who can hit a three-pointer, that's who every team wants, and the Warriors sort of paved the way for that.
Yeah, I think so. And I think there was a bit of money ball going on there. I think the owners figured out that if you could shoot 45% from three and you either took a three-point shot or a 10-foot shot, why take a 22-foot shot when you could take a 23-foot shot and get rewarded with an extra point? And I think that just as you'd learned a lot about Moneyball from the Oakland A's, I think a lot of people are going to be looking at Moneyball in basketball now, and I'm waiting for that book to come out, aren't you, Nate?
Yeah, I think Joe Lacob, the Warriors owner, was ready to write the thing himself, but after this loss, it might slow him down a little.
Yeah, it might. He might want to do a re-edit. Hey, a quick thing on this Cleveland front. You know, here we have a 52-year drought for major professional sports city, and that's over for Cleveland. So let's talk about the other cities now that are really looking for a win, Nate.
Yeah, I mean, we've done the most sad sports cities. We've gone team without a longest title drought. You know, my heart will always go to the cities that haven't won a title yet. Buffalo, San Diego, Charlotte, and Nashville are the four big ones that are still holding out. Buffalo, especially with the Jim Kelly years and everything that city's been through. I'm pulling so hard.
No, it's really tough. You know, have you ever heard the joke that Buffalo is a drinking town with a football problem?
Yeah.
Yeah. And what about Cincinnati? What about Cincinnati?
Cincinnati, you know, they are the ones who, depending on how you view the pain, they have won. The last champion was the 1990 Reds. But it's been 26 years since they've tasted victory. And, you know, with all these cities finding success, the Chicago's, the Kansas City's, now Cleveland, I think it's Cincinnati's turn. They're ready to get back up on top. So I don't know what team's going to do it, but maybe the Bengals can figure something out next year.
Yeah, and some of the other cities you pointed out, the droughts, Minneapolis-St. Paul, 25 years, 1991 Twins, Washington, D.C., wow, 25 years. It was the 1991 Hogs, the Redskins, and that really tough, tough team. Toronto, 23 years. So a lot of these cities, if you're listening, good luck to you, and I pity you. Hey, Nate, the other day we ran a piece on Pistol Pete Maravich because it was his birthday, and we do this days in history. Sometimes it's George Washington, but we believe that people like Pistol Pete, their stories are as relevant. And we were playing a clip from Bill Walton, who had noted that Pistol Pete averaged something like 44 points a game through his three years at LSU, but he took a lot of threes. In fact, when they went back and looked at the footage and did a calculation, they figured that he averaged sinking 13 threes a game, and if there had been a three-point shot, he would have averaged 56 or 57 points a game. Talk about Pistol Pete, because as we talk about these shooting guard forwards who can pass and run and do it all, Pistol Pete invented the position.
Yeah, I mean, he was basically the first shoot-first point guard. You know, before that, and even for 30 years after that, point guards were viewed as guys who dribbled the ball up and passed to the big guy down low. Pistol Pete Maravich wasn't waiting to do that. He was just going to shoot the ball. And it is funny because, you know, Steph Curry, I think everyone refers to him as the greatest shooter who ever lived. Pistol Pete Maravich was probably the greatest shooter who ever lived, mostly because that range, it wasn't being specialized. No one was telling anyone to do that. You know, nowadays, everyone's training for three-pointer. You learn to take that shot. You practice it. Maravich could just do it.
Yep.
No one was telling him to shoot from that far away.
Right.
But that was where he found space, and he knew he could make it from anywhere. Larry Bird was another player like that. You know, if the three-pointer was as important as it is now, who knows how many points they would have scored a game, both
yeah,
those guys.
It is so true. And you know, the other thing, we had after the show the other night, you know, a lot of the guys and gals here had not seen Pistol Pete play. So I just said, let's do a YouTube search. And up comes, you know, the 10 greatest plays by Pistol Pete Maravich. Eight of them are passes. Seven or eight are passes. And those no-look passes, as Magic Johnson told his kids, and I don't know if you know this, but at the funeral, Magic Johnson pulls aside Pete Maravich's kids and said, hey, you know, I didn't invent Showtime or the no-look pass. Your dad did. And no true words are spoken, Nate.
He was so far ahead of his time in terms of style, in terms of the way he played the game. Just, I mean, decades and decades ahead of his time in the way that he played. And it is too bad that he passed away before, you know, we could really get a ton of footage of him, because the stories you read just about stuff he was doing at LSU would blow your mind.
Yep. And it's interesting that he ends up playing for the New Orleans Jazz, and what we were watching was pure jazz. It was pure jazz. Hey, I want to talk about his story from For the Win. And, you know, we often, when we're watching professionals, whether it's golf or even in the Olympics, we'll watch something, somebody get like an 8.0 in gymnastics, and we'll think, wow, that person wasn't very good, because we're comparing them to like the greatest. And, well, there was a little thought experiment that occurred at For the Win as it related to, let's just say, amateurs challenging somebody they think they can beat who's in the NBA. Talk about this story and For the Win.
Yeah, Jared Dudley, the player for the Washington Wizards, and he's one of those guys that when you're watching, he's not the tallest player on the court, he's not the fastest, but he's extremely smart, and he's a great teammate, and teams want him there for a reason. But someone on Twitter said to Jared Dudley, you know, on everything, I would beat Jared Dudley one-on-one by the score of 11-6, which I appreciate the specificity there.
Yep.
And Jared Dudley said, I'll play you for $5,000, your ball, I'll spot you 5 points, and if you have a girl, bring her so she can get embarrassed. is great trash talk, but also you just have to realize these guys are just on such a different level than any of us. You know, if they have 10 open shots, they're making 9 of them.
Yep.
And they're used to playing with 7-footers running at them with hands in their faces. So if they're just playing you or me, they're going to win easily. So don't do that. Don't play that guy for $5,000.
Yeah, it's a silly. Unless you want to make a charitable donation, then go ahead and
exactly.
Do it. And by the way, we're always seeing them in the context of the greatest in the world. I was an all-state ball player in high school. I was really good. And then when I went AAU and I was playing against other really good guys who were going to be D1 players, I learned really quick, Nate, that there's another level. And then there's another level above that, and then another level above that. And you quickly are humbled in the sports world. Don't challenge NBA or professional golfers to a round or a game for money. It's silly. Nate Scott, thanks for all you do at For the Win.
Thanks, Lee.
You bet. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. For the Win is at FDWUSAtoday.com. More after these messages. This is Our American Stories, and now it's time for our weekly Marriage on the Mind segment with our marriage coach, Deb Wolniak, the executive director of Great Marriages for Sheboygan County in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. Every week, Deb joins us for storytelling on marriage. If you have a story about marriage, any marriage, yours or anyone else's, give us a call at 844-627-8255. Leave your story or a question there, and we'll make sure to get back to you within 24 hours. That's 844-627-8255. This week, Deb brings us a story with a young man named Bryant, a story that's quite different from much of our storytelling. But it's an important story nonetheless, because Bryant is clearly tapping into a nerve in our culture. Let's take a listen.
So, Bryant, I'm really glad that you joined us today because you're going to bring us into the world of the single American male. Give us a little more about your background, your history.
I'm 30 years old. I graduated from UWM with a BDA in finance and marketing in 2007. From there, I started my own company, ran that for 5 years. That was a post-production company for Walt Disney Pixar. From there, I moved back to Wisconsin, worked for Harley-Davidson. And from there, this past January, I left Harley-Davidson to start my own company. So long story short, former model, Ford Inc., the largest agency in the country, multilingual, world-traveled. I'm generally just a pretty easygoing guy. And, yeah, I absolutely have no intention to get married.
That's amazing. Because when you first shared that with me, I was like, what?
Half my friends are either married, the other half are already divorced. I've got friends that are paying alimony. I've got, you know, for what? For why? Like, for able-bodied adults, alimony, for what? Like, this is what I'm looking at. The ones who are married don't seem particularly happy. They definitely don't seem like their former selves. And the ones who are divorced, they're like, I'm never going back to that again. And you got to ask yourself, a guy like me, not just my friends, but we're talking about everybody I look up to, the Kobes, the Arnolds. I mean, how many more great men who are smarter than me, men who are at the top of their craft, Tigers, how many more men like that do I have to watch get chopped in half in some family court before I go, you know, maybe this isn't the best one for me. I do a risk-benefit assessment and say, what am I getting in exchange for all this risk as a guy with assets that I've accumulated? What am I getting?
Right. So in other words, you've seen a lot of people that you care for go through very difficult, painful things like divorce, and it's affected them emotionally as well as financially, correct?
I mean, and again, people might be tempted to say, oh, his parents want you to be divorced. Absolutely not. My parents, they're some of the most happily married. I think, what do they have? Deb, you know them. Their 40th, 50-year anniversary. They're great. They're great, and they're an inspiration. But the truth is, that was then, and this is now. And I say that because back in their days, those kind of marriages were the standard. And now that's the exception. And that's what you're bordering on the precipice of. I mean, when you pass that 50% point, you have to ask yourself, would you stick your hand into a bowl M&M's where you half of them were going to make you sick? I mean, Russian roulette is considered reckless. And that's what, one in the chamber out of eight? What does that make four out of eight odds? You know, what kind of guy is going to sign up for, hey, is this the line to lose half my stuff?
So one of the questions I know the audience listening might be screaming about is like, do you feel that there is such a thing as true love? Or sacrificial love?
I do not believe in some ethereal soul bond. I'm very, you know, my generation's pretty agnostic. We're pretty secular. But if there is such a thing as compatibility, like me and my parents case, those are two very compatible people. That's all I just talk about is compatibility. I don't put an extra supernatural or spiritual spin on it, like they're destined and they're intertwined in the cosmic realms for eternity. I don't know about all that. That sounds nice, and I'm not ruling it out. I'm just saying they're very compatible and they're great together. And if there's something like that out there for me, that's great. But I don't see why the state needs to get involved. I don't see why I need to have a contract.
Are you talking about premarital contracts or marriage?
I'm not talking about prenuptial. I'm talking about marriage. I'm talking about going down to the courthouse and getting an actual marriage certificate to make this person.
Okay.
Part of, I just don't see the point. You're talking about, and again, this is from a guy's standpoint, a lot of these guys that end up in these family courts, which are half, and that's assuming the other half are happy, which is generous. But even if they were all happy, even if the poor sass, the half, that get raped over the coals, those guys go to family courts and they do not get fair treatment. Like, I've seen that happen. I've seen them get deprived of their children. These guys, they want to be a father. You know, the guys get a bad rap for being deadbeat dads, and they're all skipping off and tomcatting. I know a lot of guys who are simply deprived of access to their children. It's like, how many of those would you have to see as a guy before you go, whoa, like, maybe this is risky. Like, what am I getting in exchange for all this risk? I don't see why I invite the state in, because every time you invite the state into it, at least in this area, they're going to side with her.
And I will say this, there are some excellent videos out there that expose the divorce industry, lawyers will immediately ask you on the front end, how much do you have? And they're not asking to help you. They're asking, how much am I going to get off this person? Right. I totally hear you, Brent, completely.
You know, like I said, I have no problem meeting women. They're always coming up to me. And we go, oh, there's your problem. No, I also approach women. I say, hey, how you doing? Can I buy you coffee? You seem interesting. I'm not a jerk about it. I'm not some Lothario. Okay, I mean, I'm out there, and I'm telling you, social media has gassed them up. That's what we say in the black community. We call it getting gassed up. It's when your ego is like, when you're a barista and you're getting the attention that you couldn't get a couple, like 50 years ago, you couldn't get that kind of attention in 10 lifetimes. And now they're getting it on the weekend. So a guy like me who sounds good on paper, all right, former model, you know, makes about 70 grand a year, world travel, multilingual, that's nice, but you're not 6'3". but you're not making 6 feet. And you get guys like me who really are, I would say, in the top 15%, certainly a black man. As a black man, I know what my income is. I know what my education is. Mm-hmm. I mean, but you get these girls who are just constantly holding out for better and better. And, you know, and they're bringing nothing to the table in return other than their bodies. I'm not interested in it. I've talked to these girls, and they're just, I'm not saying all of them, but a lot of them. And the idea that there's enough left over for everybody to find their soulmate, it's just not true. I think there's just not enough for everybody.
That's a powerful, powerful statement. So I'm going to throw this out to you. Do you believe, like your group of friends, if you were all in a room, although those pieces are valued at this point in life, if it presented itself as the right situation, with the right woman that had those qualities you were looking for, trustworthy, hardworking, responsible, intimate, you know, all those pieces, especially that intimate word, because that's a really big piece. We're just not machines. We have an intimacy level that we crave. And if it showed itself like that, would the guys in the room say, yeah, I'd take that? Or would they say, no, I'm still going to walk away?
They would, because most of my guy friends are married, but I would not. I will not get married. Nothing, none of that changes the risk of what I said. And this is the thing. People don't hear those numbers. Half, we're talking about half. That is not some insignificant rounding error. Half. Mm-hmm. You know, do I want to lose half of all that I own? If I want to have a 50% chance of losing everything I ever owned, possibly being deprived from my child's life, my own progeny, in their formative years, going through some protracted battle in a family court, most of my friends are married, and they don't seem particularly happy, to be perfectly honest.
Well, and it's not that you're fear-based. I mean, people need to hear that. It's not that you're fear-based. You're really looking at this from
a risk benefit.
It's a risk analysis. It's simple math, says Bryant. And let me tell you, there was a little bit of laughing here, but there's a lot of seriousness here. And for any father who's wanted access to his child and couldn't have it, and who felt like he didn't get a shot at the legal system, my goodness, this is dead serious. And Deb always brings us this kind of talk. It's not all rainbows. When we come back, Deb Wolniak, we're going to talk about Bryant. Why are so many young men opting out of marriage and young women? More after these messages on Our American Stories. And we're back with our Marriage on the Mind segment with our marriage coach, Deb Wolniak. And Deb, before the break, we heard some of your great conversation with Bryant. And during the break, you and I were talking. The guys and gals here, we were laughing. And it was serious, though, what this guy was saying. I mean, he was bold and he was out there. But you've heard this before, haven't you, Deb?
I have, but it's what's really breaking my heart is it's becoming more popular and more upfront. And I, after speaking with him, I do see some relative points that are absolutely true, and the eyes are wide open. And people that are not seeing this, maybe they haven't been around somebody that's younger that's experiencing this, you need to talk to them. You need to say, what are you seeing out there, and what are you experiencing? It's critical.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, we're so many of the people who are in the what I call the pro-marriage movement, and that is we're trying to let people know marriage gets you to live longer. It makes you happier. You even have a better sex life, and you have more actual sex. All the science proves this. All the data says this. But in our day-to-day experience, life is anecdotal. And so if you know 8 married couples or 10, 4 of them are divorced, 2 are miserable, and 2 are happy, you are actually looking at the math and thinking, what makes me so special? I have a 75% chance of being unhappy and a 50% chance of being divorced and unhappy. Right. He's right. I mean, those are bad numbers.
Right. So I'm going to just start right now with a football term, offense and defense. Right now, Bryant is playing defense,
yep.
And he has to, because we're in a culture that really, really does go bias for women. And now let's respect all boundaries. I know there's women's heads exploding right now. Listen to me. Not every case is the same. Let's just kind of talk out just a general variable here. You can debate me later. But here's the thing. When you're on the defense, you're already looking at how far behind you are, and you're looking at what currently is happening in the culture. Now, the thing I appreciate about Bryant, eyes wide open, what's my reality here? And also, he knows what he wants. And I would never tell a single person, well, you have to be married. If that is his true heart's desire, it is good for a man to be single. That is okay. Now, this is a man who doesn't hate women. He loves women. He loves his mom. He loves his parents. He loves his sister. He respects women. And he doesn't take advantage of them in any, you know, sexual way. He's not like it. He's removing himself from those things. And I respect the fact that he's doing that. Now, this is a guy raised in a traditional home, went to youth group. I met him. Actually, his family was good family friends of mine from church. Went to youth group, all this stuff. So he's gotten really a great background. He's done exceptionally well in life. I mean, he's been above and beyond. And I'm telling you, to have somebody look at the situation like this on that defensive mode is good with his eyes open. It's his decision, but it also kind of slightly breaks my heart, because I think there's just a little more. If somebody says, you know, I would like to entertain the marriage option. So Bryant, God bless him. He's going to be single. That's great. He's going to have a great life. It's going to be awesome. If somebody listening to this says, I'm kind of leaning that way, but I just want something more. I really do feel that marriage is for me. Then I want somebody to really stop and think and take an inventory, not only of themselves and what they're looking for, but then also then look at what is a healthy marriage and offensively be able to take control of the situation, learn what a healthy relationship is, what that consists of, and start making your list, your wish list of who it is you might be looking for. Because as that person comes in the door and you just take that first glance and you go, there's something different about that person, and you get to know them, really take time to get to know them before you ever have intimate relations. Because once you throw intimacy, and I'm talking sexual, premarital sex or sexual intimacy into the equation, you will have a different burden than you would if you didn't have that. You have more of a freedom to walk away if you find out that there's a point where you have to. Once you start that sexual relationship and that bonding, there's something that goes on emotionally there, and you start getting invested and you sign the lease together, and then it's 4 or 5 years later and you go, maybe I don't want to do this anymore. And it's harder to back out. I've heard of people getting married because they don't want to break the lease. They don't want to have to make the payment. Or, oops, I'm pregnant. Now he wants to marry me. Does he really want to marry me? Or is he just feeling sorry for me? So you can see the foundation of that marriage that is hopefully coming up, and we want people to get married no matter what. But listen, that foundation has to be even keel, and those foundational pieces have to be set, and you have to hold the relationship in the right and proper order to build a healthy relationship. And we are forgetting that. Bryant will tell you he loves his parents' relationship. He feels like that's so hard to get. I've talked to other millennials who have said the same thing. I don't know if I can find somebody out there that values some of those traditional pieces. I had a girl crying in my office the other day, because I'm not living with my boyfriend. Everyone thinks I'm crazy. So, you know, seriously, we have to take a breath, people, and stop and slow down and be very purposeful into our relationships.
You know, we did an hour with a professor at Boston College. I think we're going to replay that in the next couple of days because it was so good. And she was a professor of, I believe, philosophy. And it was a big class. But when she got to know the kids, and she's a good Catholic girl, and she wanted to get into relationships, that is, get to understand her kids. And over, she kept hearing the same thing from particularly girls. The Tinder world had made life really difficult for them. The hookup culture, the Thursday night, let's get liquored up and let's maybe hook up. And so she started a dating class. And with dating rules, it started with 15 kids, then 30. Now it has like 1,000 kids in it, and they love it. And they love the rules. They love the. And so marriage sprang, and the parents that he so looks up to and wishes he could replicate sprang from a culture that really did respect relationships. And now, I mean, I look at young people, and if I were Bryant at the same time, given now and seeing everything that's coming at him, I might be thinking the same darn thing. You'd have to have a pretty solid spiritual sense of yourself to think, yeah, I want to jump into that shark tank.
Right, exactly. Well, you brought up a good point. So we speak to all backgrounds that are listening to the radio, some of faith, some not of faith. Now, those of you who are of faith, let's just take it from this standpoint. If you get to know somebody on a spiritual level, that is a whole nother level that you're going to experience, not only intimacy-wise, but you're going to also know a little bit of their moral compass. You can actually debate from that point. And that's why having a spiritual component, especially if you're like-minded spiritually, that's a huge benefit to a marriage, because your decision-making process comes alongside that piece. Even if you're very opposite in opinion, you can kind of go back to that spiritual landmark and say, okay, this is where it started. Okay, where are we? All right, let's land on this. Let's agree to move ahead. Boom. So that actually helps a lot. For folks that maybe one is spiritual, one is not, for those people to respect those boundaries, you know, and how they think and learn and understand and develop their communication pattern, that's going to take some effort, extra effort. Let's face it, it does. But that also, you have to really work at it. And that's the thing I think some people forget. Marriage takes work. Marriage is not perfect. You will experience strife either in or out of marriage. When you're together, yes, once you're married, you will have strife. But it's how you work through it, and you can do it in a healthy pattern. And maybe even not like your parents, in a way that you decide and that you can learn. That's what we do at Great Marriages all the time, is teach healthy relationship patterns in order to have a productive, healthy, fun marriage. And yes, that does affect your sex life. So work with that a little bit.
You bet. You know, and I think when we're talking to someone like Bryant, I mean, I think what you did so well in that interview is you just listened. You let him go. There's nothing we can say to him to sell him on marriage in any one given time. But I do think over time, I think there are ways to influence him. We have a few minutes left here, Deb. What would you say? You know that Bryant. You know him. How would you get into his head and at least open that possibility to marriage? What would you do?
Yeah, so one of the things, and I've actually spent a few more hours with him. I've probably been on the phone with him for about 6 hours since we first started. And one of the things I love to do is I love to seek to understand. And that's really important for anybody in a relationship, no matter what that relationship is, at work or at home. Seek to understand what that person values or what they're saying. And then the second thing is I want people to establish a context for what that person is talking about. So Bryant's context, in this day and age, you can see the media, you can see what's selling and marketing, you can see the pressures that people have on them. Let's face it, they have a debt load coming across in their generation that the previous generations have handed down to them, and they're concerned about that. They want to volunteer. They want to get their hands in the dirt. They want community. They really do. But again, when they're talking about these issues, these heart issues, come back to what context are they talking about? And then from that point, encourage them. Encourage them positively in the relationships that they hold. Respect their opinions, but then also keep that conversation going, because we're all learning and we're all growing, and we all want to encourage each other to get to the next best level for ourselves, our heart, and also our spouse or significant other, and frankly, our families. Because guess what? These guys are going to be having kids at some point too. If they choose to get married, or if they have a relationship and they have children, the next generation is coming, and they're going to be looking at them just like these guys have been looking at us. to show us the way of what is a good relationship. And I pray that we do not lose the ability to speak into healthy relationship. Remove the hate, replace it with love, and look for the positive way and the healthy way to hold that relationship.
Well, well said, Deb. And I also think we can lead by example, and that is work on our marriages and show the young people that marriage is a good thing. It's not a drag. It doesn't stink. There are tough times, but imagine, I can't imagine my life without marriage. I can't imagine it. And so on that note, marriage on the mind, Deb Walniak, as always, thanks so much for all you do with us.
Thank you.
You bet. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. And that, of course, is Deb Walniak, Great Marriages for Sheboygan County in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. More after these messages. Habib with Our American Stories, and now it's time for our This Day in History segment, brought to us by Hillsdale College, the best place in America to learn about our nation's history, the Constitution, great literature, all the things that matter in life. Over the next hour, we are going to tell you one heck of a story about a man whose vision and determination revolutionized the world. You all know his name. Now you're about to know his story.
He is arguably the most influential man of the 20th century. He was praised by everyone from Presidents Woodrow Wilson and Herbert Hoover to the notorious gangsters, Public Enemy Number One John Dillinger and Bonnie and Clyde. He's a man who changed how we all live. He gave us the Model T, the V8, and the traffic jam.
Henry Ford, I suppose, is a candidate for this elusive title of the most representative American ever, because he did and symbolizes so many things that I think are characteristic of this country's historical development.
The Model T greatly expanded Americans' mobility, knitting America very close together at the same time that it opened American sense of what was possible. So he liberated, at the individual level, the human spirit.
Henry Ford was a revolutionary. He changed all of 20th century America. We're living in Henry Ford's world right now.
Johnny O'Connor owned an automobile. He took his sweetheart for a ride last Sunday. He was dressed up in his best Sunday clothes.
More books have been written about auto pioneer Henry Ford than any other person in the car business. Though he has critics, he put the world on wheels with his famous Model T.
I have a daughter who is hungry for love.
But less well known is the fierce independent streak that led him to wage a lone and heroic battle for the right to run his own business. It was a struggle against the kind of people who think they should have the power to determine what is best for the rest of us. This is the story of Henry Ford. The year is 1903. America is becoming the most powerful nation on Earth, transformed from a post-Civil War wasteland into a budding superpower by a group of visionaries who battled the impossible to build unimaginable empires that have brought the country into the 20th century. Henry Ford is among this new generation of businessmen, and he is facing a new set of challenges as he struggles to get his company off the ground.
I have set out to build the best motor car for popular use. The Ford motor car is durable and light, weighing only 1,000 pounds. It has a four-cylinder engine and is capable of speeds up to 45 miles an hour. It is priced at $900 compared to $1,500 for the average licensed car, which makes it the first car affordable for the common man.
Young entrepreneur Henry Ford has created a new kind of car. But in order to sell it, he needs to get permission from the Association of Licensed Automobile Manufacturers, also known as ALAM. ALAM owns the patent on the automobile, giving them complete control over who can manufacture and sell cars. ALAM chooses the winners and the losers for the future of the auto industry. They are, in a sense, a giant car monopoly, and Ford's future now rests in their hands.
Thank you, Mr. Ford. We'll be in touch.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Ford is hopeful he'll be approved by ALAM, allowing him to start his own business and to pursue his dream for the future of the car industry.
When Ford entered the automobile business, people didn't drive their own cars. They had drivers. And so cars were seen as this luxury item. Ford's insight was that cars could be an everyday item. They could be very utilitarian. So that it was within the reach of ordinary people.
Good luck, Henry. Oh, Daddy.
Ford has spent years developing his car for the common man. He builds his first gasoline-powered horseless carriage at the age of 33 and calls it the Quadricycle. But the vehicle is expensive to produce and prone to breaking down. Ford's second attempt, the Model A, is much more suited to the needs of modern America. But he can't begin selling it without permission from ALAM.
ALAM was successful in blackmailing other automobile companies, saying, you have to be licensed by us or we will sue you, and we own this patent.
After months of deliberation, the ALAM board reaches its decision. Henry Ford's application is rejected. He is one of the first applicants to be refused a license. At 40, he is broke and appears to be all washed up. ALAM sees Ford as a loser, and the rejection is their way of telling him that he had no right to be in the business. It's a crushing blow. The auto cartel has stopped him in his tracks. He just needs to find a way around what appears to be an impassable fortification. It's a daunting task, but Henry Ford has been preparing for this moment his entire life.
And when we come back, how Henry Ford did it, and my goodness, at 40, broke, and most people would have just quit, you know, when you're fighting against forces that big. And by the way, this still goes on today, how the government often colludes with private business to block competition, and how big business tries to block small business. And Henry Ford was not going to be denied. When we come back, more of this remarkable American story, the good and some of the bad, after these messages. Our American stories. On this day in history, Ford Motor Company was incorporated. And we left off with Henry Ford facing seemingly insurmountable obstacles. In his early 40s, broke, beaten down by a cartel. What the heck was next? Let's take a listen.
Okay.
It's July 30th, 1863. The Civil War is still raging, and it's 30 years before the first automobile appears in the U.S. Farmers William and Mary Ford have their first surviving child in Dearborn, Michigan. They name him Henry. Henry's parents expect all their five children to work alongside them on the land. But Henry finds the work tedious, and when he begins obsessing over machines that might make farm life easier, his parents indulge their naturally curious child. They allow him to neglect his chores and set up a workbench for him in the kitchen.
Henry Ford was a natural-born mechanic. He had innate ability. One of the first places that he was able to begin to hone that ability was when he received a watch for his birthday. Like a lot of little boys who wanted to know about machines, he took that watch apart. Unlike most little boys, he was able to put the watch back together again.
When his siblings received wind-up toys for Christmas, they had to hide them from Henry, or he would take them apart to see their inner workings, writes Phil Anschutz.
Push harder now, push harder. Oh, push. Here, I can see it coming.
Then, in 1876, Henry's 12-year-old world falls apart.
Just did.
I'm going up tomorrow.
You can't! She's in heaven now. She's with the angels. And the little baby, he's dead too.
A few months later, while traveling down the road with his father, Henry gets his first close-up view of a steam-powered road roller.
Oh, what's that?
Looks like a stove on wheels.
He ain't got no horses. It's that engine making the wagon go.
Also known as a steamroller. A bulky vehicle that chugged along country roads and performed farm chores for hire.
Henry, you come back here. Listen to your father. Henry, you little devil, yeah.
I've never seen a wagon move, not pulled by horses.
Steam power, boy.
I've seen a steam engine at harvest running a cornhusker, but I never saw one pull a wagon. How's it work? Where'd you come from?
Detroit!
How long did it take? How fast can it go? Who built it? Did you build it, mister? How did you do it?
For Henry Ford, this was like the road to Damascus, a glimpse of the full potential of the Industrial Revolution and free market capitalism. Not merely brute factory power, but mobility, the capacity of a machine to venture deep into the countryside, off the beaten track, far from the railroad, and enhance the lives of farmers who had previously felt cut off from things. Formal education didn't much interest young Henry. He quit school after the fifth grade. Like his future friend Thomas Edison, he finds satisfaction by working with his hands on a complicated task. At some point after seeing the road roller, Ford begins dreaming of building his own mobile contraption. On a cold day in December 1879, Henry walks the 9 miles from his family farm to the city of Detroit. There, he would reinvent himself. Then, on a spring day almost 10 years later in 1888, wearing a wedding dress she had made herself, Clara Jane Bryant, who had grown up on a nearby farm, married Henry Ford. 3 years later, Henry Ford took a job in Detroit at the Edison Illuminating Company, working his way up to chief engineer by the age of 31. With his canny source of rugged engineering, he would stay in the shop long after hours, tinkering with machinery and doing his own experiments. As the years passed, however, he begins to spend less time worrying about providing electricity to the citizens of Detroit and more on what has become his after-hours obsession.
Transportation in America was terrible once you got away from the railroads. Terrible. It was an enormous burden. I mean, if you're living on the farm, getting around on land is one of the biggest problems people have.
Adam, hurry,
Merry Christmas to you, Henry.
In 1893, Ford sets out to build the gasoline-powered vehicle that had been taking shape in his mind.
Henry Ford had an enormous capacity for concentration. He became something of a mad professor when he was actually working on a project. And so when he was building his first internal combustion engine, his own version of it, he got so wrapped up that he brought it home on Christmas Eve when his poor wife was cooking the turkey and getting the meal ready and everything.
Oh, everything's all right to plan for. Will you see what I got here? This is something that'll pop your eyes out. This is a beauty.
I'm sure it's wonderful, Henry, but your supper's getting cold.
Just close your eyes. It's a surprise. Close your eyes. Don't peek. Ready? Ready? Voila!
What is it?
It's an engine. Gasoline, internal combustion engine.
Oh.
And right in the middle of all this, he stuck the machine on the kitchen sink, screwed it to the sink, got his wife, whose hands were all covered with gravy and stuff, to actually drip gasoline into the top of it.
Now, here's the gas. Here, that's gas. Now, I want you to drip it in that lower funnel there, okay? Drip it in nice and steady now, okay? Drip it in nice and steady. Keep going steady. Here we go.
Connected the wires and started the machine and was quite oblivious to the fact that he was filling the kitchen with clouds of exhaust smoke.
Henry Ford is determined to show the world that to succeed in America, all you need is integrity and ingenuity. He was once asked, "What is your greatest ambition?" Ford shot back, "To be free, a free man." Ford knew that he could not be free so long as alum clouded the destiny he had marked out for himself. Ford is left with few options, but he isn't about to give up on his dreams.
Ford thought that the whole thing was ridiculous, that there could not be a patent on the idea of the automobile, that the automobile was not the property of one single individual.
And that's where we leave things off in this segment. When we come back, we're going to learn what Henry Ford does next. First segment, we got that major obstacle in his life. Second segment, which you just heard, we go back in time. By the way, in Out Where the West Was Won, and by the way, we love this book. And again, Out Where the West Was Won is by Phil Anschutz and chronicles so many of the pioneers, the business pioneers that made this country happen. When we study history, we rarely think of the businessmen. We must. We put them in the center. Also, The Myth of the Robber Barons, which is a must read. And Professor Bert Folsom at Hillsdale College wrote it. And we've done some of those. You can go to OurAmericanNetwork.org and, my goodness, take a listen to a few of them and you'll love them. And the idea that these men were robber barons is just a misnomer. And we like to take back history from those who've tried to distort it and give it to you straight as can be. No politics. Just tell the story of these men. And again, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And we'll get into some of the parts of Henry Ford's life that were not so pretty. But for the most part, on balance, one of the greats of the 20th century. And my goodness, his contribution to our economy, to the middle class. And I just wanted to read one thing really quickly. It's how the chapter starts off. Henry Ford, and again, Out Where the West Was Won by Phil Anschutz. "My ambition," said Henry Ford, "is to employ still more men to spread the benefits of this industrial system to the greatest possible number to help them build up their lives and their homes." And so said Henry Ford, who did more than anyone in America to move the majority of the citizens of this country into the automobile-owning middle class. When we come back, what Henry Ford does next will astound you. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories, our This Day in History segment. The Ford Motor Company was incorporated on this day in history. And as always, our This Days in History brought to you and us by Hillsdale College, the best place in America to learn about our nation's history, the Constitution, great literature, and as always, all the things that matter in life. We now pick up with the story of Henry Ford and his ongoing battle with alum.
Ford is determined to get around alum's stranglehold on the auto industry. But he's just one man going up against a virtual monopoly. If he's going to be a success without alum, he's going to need to make a name for himself.
It's a very simple thing on the make or break decisions, the gut. And that's what separates the great leaders and the great successes. And if you can't listen to it, you don't have it, you're never going to get it. Because it's never going to come from someplace else.
Listen to that 40 horse.
Yeah, well, we're not ready now. We never will be. Partner, let's go.
Let's go. Come on.
Henry Ford challenges the owner of the biggest car company in the country to a race.
It's just us, Mr. Ford. It's no interest in watching me circle the track with you following me those extra miles.
Wenton, I don't even aim on seeing you at the finish.
Gentlemen, start your engines.
Alexander Winton is known as the fastest driver in America and is also a prominent member of alum. Beating Winton with a car of his own design has the potential to give Ford the boost he needs to start his own company. There's just one problem. Henry Ford has never raced a car before.
It's a David and Goliath scene. Winton's famous world record holder has this fancy race car. Ford, the local boy, made good.
For the first third of the 10-mile race, Ford lags behind Winton, struggling to control his car on the curves because he doesn't have any brakes. Then, on the sixth lap, he starts to close the gap.
Losing oil!
As Winton's engine begins to overheat and smoke, the crowd erupts as Ford zooms past his rival, winning the race by nearly a mile.
We did it!
I know you can do it! I know it all the time!
Henry Ford's upset win over the fastest man in America makes him instantly famous.
Ford's a hero, and this is really the first big time, I think, that he becomes a celebrity. The Ford name gets out there, and he milks it for everything that it's worth. And it was a very crucial part of Ford getting investors for the Ford Motor Company.
But Ford's success is met with almost instant defeat.
Henry, you're fired. Well, pretty hard to fire a fellow who's got his name on the automobile, don't you think?
No, I've taken care of that, Henry. We're naming the company after the French explorer who founded Detroit. We're naming it Cadillac.
William Murphy, like the key that. Financial backer, fires Ford and starts another car company.
Gather your things, Henry. You're finished.
Ford leaves with his name, $900, and a dream.
Take away my car, give me $900, take my name off the door. Dream of making a motor car where the farmer could go into the city and the city fella could go out into the country and see the grandness of it all. Understand it. Meet each other, understand each other.
Ford raises $28,000, or $700,000 today. On June 16th, 1903, Ford has enough money to incorporate the Ford Motor Company. And before long, he's producing 15 cars a day, priced low enough for almost any American. But Ford's investors propose an alternative way to increase profits.
While we all appreciate the great good fortune we've enjoyed this first year, let me say that these profits are only the beginning. I propose that we raise the price of an automobile dramatically and go off to the top part of the market.
From the beginning, there seemed to have been two strands in American car making. There were the people who were making horseless carriages for the rich, loading them down, making them heavy and luxurious. And then there was Henry Ford, who had this idea that A car should be able to go along the rutted tracks. It should be able to drive across a plowed field. A farmer should be able to use it and take a wheel off it and fix a chain to it and cut some trees down or husk some corn. That was all he was interested in from the start.
I'm interested in building more cars for more people for less money. I'm not interested in the big man or the rich man. I'm interested in a little fella who's never been able to afford anything special. I want to give him an automobile that's going to open up his world. Open up his eyes. And nobody's greed, is going to take that away from him. Or me.
Henry Ford's early success puts him on the map. Alum takes notice and hits him with a lawsuit, claiming he's breaching their patent on the automobile.
You see all these huge conglomerations suing people over patents. The big guys are taking advantage of the little guys, trying to find whatever angle they could and using their might, and those with the best tricksters win.
In Detroit, Michigan, a panel of federal judges will decide whether Ford can continue to freely manufacture and sell his car. The Association of Licensed Automobile Manufacturers is suing Ford for a royalty on every car he sells. Ford knows those royalties would drive up the cost of his car, putting it out of the reach for the average consumer. For most early car makers, the lawsuit would be a devastating setback. But for Ford, it's something different, an opportunity.
People react to failure in one of two ways. Either they get scared and give up, or they take that failure that as a learning experience, and they kind of use that experience to redouble their efforts.
Here comes Mr. Ford.
Good morning, sir.
How are you?
Good to see you.
Ford is convinced the era of unchecked monopolies is over. So as his lawsuit winds its way through court, he openly defies the order from Alum and continues building and selling his cars. He believes there's a better way to conduct business in America, and he's determined to make it a reality.
What about a union? Let them form a union?
After they hear the news I'm going to give you, they're not going to want to hear the word union. As of tomorrow, every Ford worker is going to get $5 a day.
Did you say $5 a day?
You heard it here. Furthermore, there'll be no more 10-hour days. As of tomorrow, 8 hours a day. Nobody has to work 8 hours a day.
And there you have it. And we have one more really remarkable segment to close out this story. But already we're learning about the nature and character of some of these men. And again, we did Rockefeller and we did Vanderbilt, two of those so-called robber barons, and now we're bringing you Henry Ford's life. And again, always brought to you by Hillsdale College and how he dealt with failure. And I got to tell you, you're listening to this story and you're thinking, how did this guy just keep going? How did he do it? And this is the thing. And this is the rub. And again, we hear this over and over again in all of these stories. And ultimately, when people do learn about Henry Ford, they learn about his anti-Semitism. And so much American history now is taught through the lens of what is wrong and what was wrong from the making of the Constitution and slavery, tragedy and terrible, the sin of omission in this great country. But put it in the context of the world, and slavery was everywhere. And so when studying history, we've got to always give the context, and we need to know what made these men great. Easy to look at their failures and their failings, because these are men, and we all have them. And anti-Semitism was a cancer. It was a virus. And Ford's reputation suffered rightly and correctly for it. But when we come back, what Ford did for this country, how he changed this country, how he changed the world, and liberated people to do what they wanted with their lives and live and go where they wanted with those lives. More after these messages. This is Our American Stories.
Thank you.
just alone on a mountaintop, staring out at the great divide. I could go east, I could go west, it was all up to me to decide. Just then I saw a young hawk flying and my soul began to rise. And pretty soon this is Our American Stories. You're listening to Bob Seger's Roll Me Away. We've all known that feeling. How many songs have been written about the feelings of freedom in a car, turning in a direction, changing your life, taking a girl somewhere, whatever. It's the most central part of American life. And Henry Ford, he practically invented it for us. He put a car within reach of all of us. Let's hear the rest of this remarkable day. This day in history, the Ford Motor Company was incorporated.
Ford's unprecedented and groundbreaking $5 a day raise is more than double the rate of most U.S. factories. But Ford isn't just paying his workers better. He's also getting more out of them. He innovates a new system for producing cars. Rather than handcrafting each car one at a time at stationary workbenches, his are assembled by a line of workers, piece by piece. It's called the Moving Assembly Line, and it completely changes manufacturing forever. But first, Ford must introduce this system to his employees.
All right, where's my running board, man? Bring in the running board. Put it right over the holes. That's it. Don't bother anything else. You go back to the next car. Now, my bolt man. Where's my bolt man? Put it right in the bolt holes. Don't bother to tighten them. Don't bother. Where's the man that's going to tighten them? You come in there. Now, next, you go back to the next car, bolt man. Cousin, how do you like that, huh?
Ford didn't invent mass production, but he perfected mass production. He understood that a complicated product like an automobile could be simplified and could be made less expensive if the same thing was produced again and again and again.
Using the assembly line, Ford's workers can build cars up to 8 times faster than any other automobile factory in the world. What once took 12 and a half man hours to assemble now takes 93 minutes. The innovation allows Ford to standardize the 8-hour workday, 5 days per week. Meanwhile, Ford awaits the future of his company. It's potentially a life-changing moment, not just for Ford, but for the future of every industry in the country. In a surprise decision, the court rules in favor of Henry Ford. Alum has no legal claim to the design of the car. Henry Ford is free to innovate without repercussion.
Well, guys, that was it. Let's go sell some cars, huh?
Ford's dream is made a reality. The car belongs to everyone.
Ford's success put him forward in American life as a new kind of businessman. The American population ate this up, and they made Henry Ford a kind of folk hero.
Ford seizes the momentum, and his factories go into overdrive. Every few months, Ford introduces a new model, making his way through the alphabet. But the Model K was too heavy and expensive. The Model N, though lighter and cheaper, had an engine cast in 4 pieces rather than 1 block. Ford kept at it.
What are we going to call this here new model?
Well, nothing fancy, just keep it simple. Use another letter out of the alphabet. Where are we now?
That's T, as I count it.
Well, call it Model T.
Model T she is, sir.
Ford finally nailed it.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the moment you've been waiting for, Mr. Ford's Model T!
It was the same kind of excitement that the Man on the Moon mission people had. There are a handful of those kinds of moments in American history where there's a dream that is so big in its potential and you think you got it, and then you get it.
First of all, I'd like
like to thank all of you for coming out here.
Ford's assembly line starts producing this revolutionary new car at a record rate. The Model T costs only $825. It's a four-cylinder, 20-horsepower, five-passenger family car. Powerful, speedy, and enduring. A car that looks good and is as good as it looks.
And I got one word for you gentlemen of the press, and that word is volume.
What's that, Henry?
Volume.
What do you mean?
We're going to make so many of these Model Ts that you're going to run out of numbers to count.
The response was immediate and overwhelming. Orders pour in from doctors and farmers. Americans who have never dreamed of becoming motorists can now afford Henry Ford's Model T.
The Model T changed everything. It gave people a new sense of power and authority and control over their lives. You can go wherever you want it, and you can go by yourself.
You can get in your car, and you have access now to towns, to cities, to places that were beyond your reach just a few years earlier.
They were also remarkably durable.
They didn't break down a lot compared to other vehicles, and when they did, they were very simple to repair. This wasn't somebody just genieing out a product. This was a quality to the economical car that the world had never even imagined could be possible.
Part of the enduring myth of the Model T is that all of them were black. But when the Model T first came on the market, customers could get almost any color except black. Blue, gray, green, and red were all available. It was not until 5 years later that the any color so long as it is black policy was finally implemented. Then in 1913, Ford enacted another amazing advancement with the implementation of standardized interchangeable parts. Unlike other cars of the time, every Model T produced on that line used the exact same valves, gas tanks, tires, etc., so that they could be assembled in a speedy and organized fashion. 1,000 cars a day rolled out of the factory in 1914, 2,000 in 1916. As productivity went up, the price went down. Soon, 60% of all cars made in the U.S. were Model Ts. Cutting prices enabled Ford to achieve what were his two aims in life: to bring the pleasures of the automobile to as many people as possible, and to provide a large number of high-paying jobs for his workers.
Henry Ford created what became the most important industry in the American economy. He had no idea of the enormous impact it would have on almost every sector of American life. He literally changed America, the way we live, the way we do things, and the way we go about our business.
Ford's reputation won't always be so positive, but his revolution inspires an entire generation of visionaries who will transform the fabric of American life. Childhood friends William Harley and Arthur Davidson attach an engine to a bicycle and begin selling motorcycles to the masses. Milton Hershey applies Henry Ford's assembly line model to the mass production of chocolate. Chicago merchant William Wrigley takes his chewing gum national. And in Hollywood, Polish immigrant Max Factor begins distributing cosmetics for movie stars to drugstores across the country, inventing a completely new consumer product, makeup. In the spring of 1947, Henry Ford returned home from vacation. On his second day back, the powerhouse that supplied his home with heat and light flooded. That evening, Henry and his wife turned in early. Power still hadn't returned, and their room was lit only by an oil lamp and a few candles. Before the night was out, Henry Ford, the father of mass production, the inventor of the modern age, the man who embodied the American dream, laid his head on his wife's shoulder and left the world just as he came into it 84 years earlier. By candlelight. In Detroit, motorists were asked to come to a complete stop at the time the automaker's body was being lowered into the ground. For that second, when the automobiles came to a stop, Detroit returned to the way Henry Ford had found it.
And great job on that, Greg. And Greg Hengler always does such great work on these pieces. And I want to close with Phil Anschutz. He wrote this in How the West Was Won. Because of Ford, many middle-class folks could become motorists. Automobiles were no longer just toys of the rich. This was particularly important to the American West, a land of vast distances and rugged obstacles. Westerners bought and used more cars than Easterners or Southerners. Visitation at national parks and other Western wonders soared once families could drive themselves cheaply and reliably in their Model T and A Fords. And many who toured the West, well, later they moved there in their Fords. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories.